Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in. You're about to listen to an author talk by John Brogdon. You're probably familiar with his name. He's an Australian businessman, former politician, former chair of Lifeline Australia, and the honorary president of Lifeline International. And he came to talk to us about his newly released book, Profiles in Hope. Just before we begin, this recording does include personal stories involving experiences of mental health conditions and touches on themes of self-harm and suicide that some might find difficult to hear and may trigger or be upsetting. We encourage you to reach out to Lifeline for support at 13 11 14 if you or a loved one is feeling impacted. These details will be included in the description. Every day, 9 Australians take their own lives. 19 years ago, John Brogdon came very close to adding his name to these statistics. But John survived, and since his recovery, he has become a passionate voice for mental health and suicide prevention. In Profiles in Hope, John has gathered together some incredible Australians to tell their stories, and he visited the SMSA to talk about his own journey and share some of those stories that are included in the book. This recording was made in the Henry Carmichael Theatre at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, which is located on Gadigal land.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today, and thank all of you for coming. I want to join in acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, but I also have to join in acknowledging my mother-in-law's bridesmaid, who is here, Judy, by great coincidence, and her son, Andrew. It's always nice to have friends in the audience. And as I said, thank all of you for coming. A couple of years ago, I came across the idea for this book. You may have noticed the title, Profiles in Hope. For those of you who may be Kennedy fans, JFK fans, in 1956, he wrote a book called Profiles in Courage. Profiles in Courage was about 8 mostly senators and US statesmen who had done courageous things, often against their own constituency, in the establishment of the American democracy. It was a Pulitzer Prize winning novel. I'm hoping for the same outcome, of course. but it was ghost-written, interestingly, which is all part of the great Kennedy veneer of many things that he did that were assisted from the outside. So Profiles in Courage is in many ways an homage to President Kennedy, although it has in the first couple of pages a quote from, of all people, Richard Nixon. I'll come to that later. So this book is the stories of 15 Australians, famous and unknown, and their experience of either suicidality, living with suicidal ideation, planning to take your own life, or actually attempting to take your own life but surviving that attempt. The starting point of this, of course, is we can't speak to somebody who completes their suicide. We don't like to say they're successful at taking their own life, but we can't talk to people who complete their suicide as much as their story about how they get there and their decision would be incredibly informative. We can't talk to them. In terms of suicide in Australia, suicide is an incredibly stubborn. About 9 Australians will take their lives today. 7 men and 2 women. Is this coming in and out? Is that better? 7 men and 2 women on average. 7 men and 2 women on average will take their own lives today. More women attempt suicide. More men complete suicide. In simple terms, men use more violent methods than women. Men use more violent methods than women. So those numbers have been the same for many, many years. It works out to be about 3,300 Australians who take their own lives every year. And of course, they are people we know, people we love, people we're connected to. The objective of this book is to inspire some hope in the area of suicidality. One of my post-political public objectives has been to normalise mental illness. So some of you with a bit of grey hair in the room will remember the days when nobody would talk about suicide, certainly, and others would not talk about what we now call depression and anxiety. My grandmother,
my beautiful grandmother, to whom this book is dedicated, along with my wife, Lucy. My grandmother would talk about people having bad moods. Oh, she has a bad mood. She's in a bad mood. Or she's very moody. Look, that could well be what we call depression today. But back then, all of these medical illnesses had wonderful names. You'd live in a street where a lady disappeared for a year off to asylum and came back, and nobody spoke about what had happened. Things like postnatal depression weren't understood. My objective is for us to understand, for us to think about and talk about, and in our hearts feel about mental illness in exactly the same way that we think about and we talk about and we feel about physical illness. All mental illness is an illness of an organ called the brain in your head. It should be treated no differently to an illness of the liver, the kidney, the knee, the foot, on and on the list goes. So that has been my great post-political public objective. And we in Australia do exceptionally well in this space. Churchill once said that democracy is the worst form of government, except all the others. We have the worst mental health system in the world, except for all the others. As I travel the world as president of Lifeline International, I can tell you that probably second only in the English-speaking world to the UK, there is nothing like a Lifeline anywhere in the world. Go to Argentina, their equivalent operates 16 hours a day, gets no government funding, struggles for volunteers. Lifeline Australia, tens of millions of government funding. I've raised millions and secured millions, tens of millions for Lifeline Australia. Very high public profile, operates 24 hours, 7 days a week. Call, text, chat. We are a leader in this space, just as we are a leader in the way that we talk about mental health. And gone are the days when people would say, "What's wrong with you? I don't understand what your problem is. Get off your backside, go and do something, get out of bed. What are you malingering about?" I think those days are gone. I think those days are gone. It doesn't mean the stigma attached to mental illness has gone. However, in contrast, I don't want to normalise suicide. I want people to choose to live rather than to die. I want people to see their way through, see the hope and the opportunity to get through difficult times, to get through that darkest of all places, and come out the other end alive. Now, that's not a moral judgment to not want to normalise suicide. It's not a values-based judgment. It's not a religious judgment. It's just a statement that just as when somebody we know gets cancer, our first reaction is, how do we keep you alive? How do we keep you going? What can we do? So should be the same reaction to somebody with chronic mental illness who may be at risk of suicide. It's challenging suicide. 50% of Australians who take their own life have never, never sought assistance, sought to meet with a mental health professional. 50%. Because suicide is broadly an act of impulse, it doesn't follow a linear process the way, say, cancer does. If you have cancer, it gets worse, it gets worse. Increases the likelihood that you will die. You can have a lifelong melancholic depression that's hard to treat and never think about suicide. Or alternatively, you can have what is a reasonably well-managed life for your mental illness. All of a sudden, your business fails, your marriage fails, some catastrophe hits you, and at that point you think about taking your own life. And if you have the means by which to take your own life, you can kill yourself, despite never having had any indication of mental illness. So you don't have to be technically mentally ill in order to take your own life. So it is a very complicated issue, I grant you that. But we've had a great journey. I say in the book that the great mental health institutions we used to call asylums, the person who used to run mental health in New South Wales, their title was the Master of Lunacy. There's an interesting business card. Some of those beautiful sandstone buildings built in the 1800s, on waterways. Why are they on waterways? Because the insane were transported to and from those places on the waterways to keep them away from you and me on the roads, we the normal people. Indeed, at Rozelle Hospital, Callan Park, there is an underground tunnel, so you can't even be seen when you get off the boat. We have come a long way. We have come a long way. We have a distance to go. And we have more to do in inspiring people with messages of hope about how they get through suicide and come out the other end. My experience that I bring to this book is very personal. I'm a Sydney boy. I grew up born in Balmain Hospital in 1969, the last year the Balmain Tigers won the grand final. I was not conceived on the night that Balmain won the last grand final. My mother reckons half of Balmain was conceived that night when we were on the grand final. Mum was one of nine children. When my younger brother came along, there were three of us, my older sister, myself and me. The house got too big and we moved to Haberfield before it was trendy. My mother was a secretary all her life. My dad was a carpenter. We were from a very working class background. Their marriage was never a good marriage. I've often said to my father, "Why did you marry Mum?" He said, "Because she asked me." I was hoping for a much deeper answer to that question, but I don't think it's ever going to arrive. So they had a very unhappy marriage from the beginning. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of abuse, and it was a very difficult time for us kids. Dad was very absent from the home because of all of this. So they got divorced when I was 13. I was the cause of that divorce. Interestingly, I became quite paranoid as a 13-year-old, thinking I was being followed. Mum took me to the doctor. The doctor sent me out for a urine test, very clever old GP, which means was thrown out of the room so he could talk to Mum about what was happening at home. And that afternoon, Mum said, "It's time for your father and I to get divorced." I never felt responsible and I never felt negative about that, because from my perspective, that would end the fighting. It was difficult. I went to a Catholic high school where I was, I think, the only kid with divorced parents. My Italian friends couldn't understand how anyone could ever be divorced. One of my mates at school actually didn't believe I was a Catholic if I'd had divorced parents. It was the early 80s. It was a difficult time. What was, however, disastrous for us and for Mum was that she had been seeing a man on the side. Now, look, when you're that age, you don't cope with that. As you get older, these things happen. And she needed companionship. When he moved in, we discovered that he was an alcoholic and that he abused her. He physically abused her. And he turned her in to an extremely heavy drinker. And you're aware of the phrase coercive control. He had it over her, and she would do anything not to lose the house. She'd do anything not to lose the house. And it was, you know, she came from that working class background where owning a home is the greatest achievement of your life, So it became very difficult for us kids. And she very much was his mouthpiece in being incredibly, incredibly negative to us as children. It all ended when I turned 18 and we all left home. Later on, she married him, hard to believe, and through that period of time when he came in, we would disappear for a week, we'd come back, we'd disappear for a week, we'd come back. On one occasion, I came home from school debating. I was the vice captain of my school. I was never the captain. I'll never get over that. You might think I'm joking, but it's true. You should meet the bloke who became captain. Anyway, so came home from debating on one Friday night. This is 1986. There's no mobile phones. You know, you don't ring home much as a kid. My brother had come home. My mother had sent him to Dad's place. My sister had come home. My mother had sent my sister to a girlfriend's place because he was on a big bender on this occasion. So I came home at 9:30 at night, couldn't get through the front door, it was locked, came around the back door, and there was Mum on this occasion having been hit in the face. And I said, "This is it, we're going, Mum, we're going." So we threw all of his clothes out. It was the middle of winter. I nailed all the windows shut in the house and we went to my grandmother's in Balmain. He came, that was a Friday night. He came over on the Sunday night. Now, it's important to understand with my grandmother, she was about this tall, and the black lacquered French roll gave her about 3 inches on top. I couldn't understand when I was a kid why everyone else's grandmother had grey hair, because my grandmother had black hair. So Nan had had 9 kids. She was old school, working class, Balmain. And he came over on the Sunday night. I don't know how he drove, because he could barely walk, and he knocked on the door and asked for my mother. Mum was hiding in the house. I was standing a few footsteps behind my grandmother. I still think I should have been. I still look back at that. Can't believe I let a 76-year-old lady shield me from this bloke. And he said, Brenda, I'm here to see Judy. And my mother slammed. My grandmother said, I've lived here for 50 years. I've never had any trouble, and I'm not about to, and slammed the door in his face. And life went back to normal. Life went back to normal. He had taken such control. We spent every other weekend at an auntie or an uncle's place. That had stopped. Scrabble was a combat sport in my family. He didn't like it. Mum couldn't play Scrabble. We had 2 gate blokes living next door to us, and we had a swinging timber gate. He bricked up the gate to keep the gay guys away. The control was extraordinary. All of that lifted. The family came back. Then into the new year, Mum started having hushed conversations in the lounge room. There's no mobile phones. This happens in the home. He came back, and then we decided we can't take this anymore. And as I said, then a couple of years later, she married him. What I did through all of that, I was the good boy. I loved being vice captain. I loved being school. Any opportunity to go to school, I would take. I didn't understand the time, but it was an opportunity not to be at home. So for me, I pushed all of that very deep down inside me. It made me an angry young man, in this case, angry to achieve in politics. I chose the Liberal Party. When I went to tell my grandmother that I joined the Liberal Party, I visited her at 20 Jane Street, Balmain. I said, Nan, I joined the Liberal Party. She said, don't worry, love, that's a passing phase you'll go through. And Pop's cousin next door, Auntie Kate, cried. She cried, oh, what have you done? What have you done? So I was the black sheep very much in the family. But I went through, I became the young Liberal president, went and tried for pre-selections, eventually was selected in the seat of Pittwater at the age of 27. And it was a very safe seat back then, not anymore. It was a very safe seat, and I was on track to go somewhere. We were in opposition. You move up the ladder quicker in opposition. I was a shadow minister at 30. I challenged and successfully won the leadership at 33. But the problem with me as I went through that journey, and visualise an escalator in a shopping centre, every time I went up to the next floor, rather than enjoy the success of what I'd achieved, I had to go faster. Not good enough. What's next? What's next? What's next? And I hope to think that I was restlessly ambitious, not ruthlessly ambitious, based on one of the great nuggets of wisdom my grandmother gave me, which is be careful who you climb over on the way up, because you'll have to climb over on the way down the ladder. And she was very true. But for me, I pushed all of that down, and it developed into a very clear depression. My wife Lucy sat there in a white-knuckled ride of fear about what was going on. If you told me that I was depressed, I wouldn't believe you. I ran as leader in the election in 2023 against Bob Carr. I always expected to lose that one and win the next one. After the election, I said to everybody, we've got to work harder. I'd already been working 6 and 7 days a week and 6 and 7 nights a week. I worked so hard they had to give me 2 drivers who worked in shifts, because I worked them so hard. And I was probably on the verge of being manic. Barry O'Farrell, who was my deputy, came in about a month or two after the election and said, John, we've got to slow down. And I said, Barry, we've got to speed up. So for me, I was almost manic, but keeping to push all of this stuff down. It all came to an end for me when I said and did some stupid things at a cocktail party. They made it to the media. I was ashamed and embarrassed about those things, and I resigned my role as leader of the opposition. But I stayed in Parliament. I thought at that point, maybe if I put myself on the backbench, maybe if I take my lumps, as Churchill or Menzies, I can't remember who said, and spend some time recovering, maybe I'll get a chance to go back to the front bench, probably never as leader again. But the next day, the media, in a tabloid attacked, did a multi-page attack on me. And I got a phone call at 6:15 at my home telling me that the Telegraph was going to run this tomorrow. That was the day after I'd resigned. And at that point, in the house we still live in a spot I can point to you, I decided that I'd lost everything, that things were going to get worse, not better, that there was to be no relief from my failure, from my shame, from my disgrace, that my wife was better off without me. We had an 18-month-year-old son. He's 21 in December. Lucy was pregnant with our second child. And I decided at that point that everybody upon whom I was a burden and everybody who I had shamed would be better off without me. I went to my office. I tried to take my own life. By a great point of serendipity, in the restaurant next door to my office in Mona Vale, one of my staff was having dinner, saw the media outside my office, opened up, called the police, and I was taken to hospital. So it took me a long time to get better, a very long time to get better. But in the weeks and really the month that followed my suicide attempt, Lucy and I received 10,000 emails, faxes. Remember them. I have to check the audience I'm with when I say faxes because there are a lot of people who've never seen one. Letters, faxes, emails, cards from 10,000 people, the majority of whom I'd never met in my life. And there was one message through all of them, and they were all positive, not a single negative one. And in general, the message was, I've been there, or my brother's been there, or my sister's been there, and we all deserve a second chance in life. This is not an autobiography. If I wrote an autobiography, the title would be based on the most extraordinary of all of those letters. So it was a guy post-restaurant Darwin Northern Territory, so he's travelling around the Northern Territory, going back to the GPO in Darwin, picking up his mail. On fluoro yellow paper, my name's John Brogdon. The letter started with, Dear Mr. Ogden, comma, we all make mistakes, that's why pencils have rubbers on the other end, full stop. Now that would be the title of my autobiography because it is the experience of my life and I think it is the experience that we as a community give those who get to that very dark point. I've been at the dark point of my life where you think not simply the only thing to do but you convince yourself the best thing to do is to take your own life. We want those people to live. We want those people to experience the hope that they can get through and come out the other side. So in this book, 15 Australians tell their stories. The book is a Q&A style. I question, they answer. Why? I thought about writing their stories, but then I thought, no, these are their stories and people should read them in their words. So among them is James Packer. So some of you may have seen the Insight program, the Channel 7 60 Minutes equivalent, a couple of Sunday nights ago before the book was formally launched. James spoke extraordinarily openly about his mental illness and about his periods of thinking about killing himself. James is in there to prove to people it doesn't matter how rich you are, or as he says, and he says this all through the chapter, how privileged he is. He says, I recognise how privileged I am. Doesn't matter how much money you've got, how big your boat is, mental illness and suicidality can visit upon you. It's interesting with James. This is an older crowd. So I spoke to a younger crowd of people a couple of weeks ago and I said to them, who's heard of OneTel? Two hands went up. I said, okay. So I said to James, tell me about your business successes. He went straight to OneTel, 20 years ago plus OneTel. I said, James, you picked the peak of the free-to-air television world, you picked the peak of magazines and sold at the peak. What an incredible success. He kept going to his negative points. And for him, his suicidality was a result of the embarrassment and the shame when he did things wrong in public. And, you know, you may have views on Kerry Packer, you may have views on James Packer. He's a friend of mine. I've known him for 20 years. When I came back, he spends a quarter of his life in his polo ranch in Argentina. which is like an extraordinary sort of 7-bed resort. And on the when I flew back, I didn't ask him for any money for Lifeline. He donated $6 million to Lifeline. Now, he didn't have to be in that book, but he wanted, I think, for people to understand him better, but to allow me to send the message that no matter how privileged you are, you can live with mental illness and it can push you to suicidality. Ian Thorpe is in the book. Ian is as recognisable as he has always been. He's, I don't know, 6'6". I'm 6'2". He's 6'5" or 6". He has the most extraordinary set of shoulders you've ever seen in your life. I mean, he's about, I don't know, he's got the biggest shoulders you've ever seen. Lovely guy, really nice guy. I said to the same crowd of people who didn't know who what OneTel was, who knows Ian Thorpe? Every hand went up. I said, Ian hasn't raced competitively in swimming for 20 years and you all know who he is. Imagine that burden of fame, the burden of fame. Ian Thorpe's first ever prize money when he was in his teens for swimming, he gave half of it, donated half of it to Lifeline. So he's been a supporter of Lifeline for a long time. But for him, it wasn't the fact that for a long time we all whispered that he was gay and he didn't talk about it. And he tells us that at 14 or 16, a tabloid journalist was sent to him at a swimming meet and was required by the editor at the risk of losing his job to ask Ian Thorpe, are you gay? Asking a teenage kid, are you gay? It's not coming out that bothers Ian at all. In fact, he's got a great line, I reckon, in 2024, which is actually it's no one else's business, which is not a bad line, right? It's no one else's business. What pushed him to the edge, and some of you might remember this, he got a first positive test on drugs at some stage, which was later overturned, and pushed very hard by his enemies in the swimming world, and that's what pushed him to the edge, that despite a career of clean swimming, that people would think that of him. He's got a fascinating way that he deals with his mental illness. So I asked him, how do you deal with it? How do you keep well? And he said, I've got this list, and on the list is... I said, there's actually... He said, oh, no, it's a written list. I said, oh, wow. He said, my friends have got the list too. He said, if I don't walk the dog for 2 days, if I'm drinking too much, if I'm eating a lot of rubbish food and a whole lot of other things, I know I'm not well. My friends know I'm not well. So that was a fascinating way that he dealt with it. There's a woman in there called Patricia Hall. Trish Hall, you've never heard of Patricia Hall. She's a 70-year-old woman. She had working class, home-owning background. Like some of you in this room of that generation, like my mother, you left school early, you got married, you had 3 kids, you're a housewife, or you had a relatively menial job. That was your life. That was your career. So that worked for Pat until her husband left her and her entire world fell to pieces. Her entire world fell to pieces. Like many people who are suicidal, she put up a front, and on the day she decided to kill herself, she rang her sister and said, oh, I'm having a good day, everything's fine. She sent the 3 sons out with the father to have a day. She locked every room, every window in the house and went into the bathroom to take her own life. Her sister thought, that's not right. That's strange that she would ring and tell me that. Sister rang the neighbour. The neighbour found the one window that Pat left open. And Pat says it's the only window that was always locked. For some reason it was open. They pushed it, young girl, threw open the door, saved her life. What does Pat do today? Pat runs Liverpool Neighbourhood Connections out there in Warwick Farm, tough part of town. She takes women off the boat. She takes women from terrible domestic violence situations. She puts them through basic training courses of $4,000, $4,500 from TAFE. So if you go to Pat and you donate $4,500, that's like $6 million to her. She makes every dollar work. She gets these women through something. Then she arranges for them to buy a coffee cart, and the next thing they've got the contract doing the coffee at Saturday morning at the Liverpool Football Club for 1,000 kids who turn up. So she gets them back into life. She's the salt of the earth, and her life has been turned around, and she's now doing great things, saving other people's lives. Peter Maloney is a farmer in his 40s, grew up in Brisbane, followed his dad into plumbing, had shocking dyslexia, thought he was dumb all his life, married a country girl, went to the bush. Like all country people, there might be some country people here, I said, oh, Peter, I'll come and see you. He said, no, I wouldn't mind it to come to Sydney. I said, okay, no problems. Now, how do we get you to Sydney? How far from Brisbane do you live? Oh, it's just 8-hour drive from Toowoomba. So he came down. He had never told his story before. This book is the first telling of his story. So he was incredibly emotional. We had buckets of tears on the way through, mine and his. And he went to he married a country girl and had to pretend he knew how to be a farmer. And that's hard. Farmers are not forgiving of people of whom they are critical. They're tough. So he had this great charade of being a farmer. He just couldn't do it anymore. He went out to the back near one of his dams with his shotgun, and as he was ready to take his own life, he heard one of his sons come up on a motorbike and he put the shotgun down. He's now become this sort of force of nature who everybody in Queensland and beyond in the bush will say, oh, Peter will give you a call, or why don't you call Peter? Or so he's got this informal network of farming men in particular for whom he is helping get through very difficult times. Probably the most extraordinary person in the book is a 24-year-old young man called Matthew Caruana. So Matthew's from the northwest of Sydney. He's got a Maltese dad and a Greek mum. Dad was he's a tradesman. His mother worked in administration running dad's business. He's the oldest of three kids. They went to a regional Catholic high school up in the northwest of Sydney. There were two Matthew Caruanas when he'd hit the age of 16. The one we didn't see, the one nobody saw, was this great burden of shame and worthlessness. He felt completely worthless, completely worthless. This Matthew Caruana was a DJ at parties, smoked a lot of drugs at the time, but also very focused on his bodybuilding. He's not a tall guy, good-looking young rooster. He's not a tall guy, but he determined that he wanted to meet a certain picture in his own mind of bodybuilding. So he put on 30 kilos, stripped down 20 kilos to get, you know, I don't know, the most extraordinary chest and arms and legs you've ever seen in your life. Took a photo of that, put it on social media. In the run-up to that, he had been visiting the place where he decided to kill himself on a regular basis to work out the best place to guarantee he would die. So we're seeing the public and the private young man. A week after he posted the photograph, he threw himself off to kill himself. He woke up 3 days later in the spinal ward at Royal North Shore, having completely severed his spine, never to walk again. Of course, his first thought, your first thought isn't it wonderful he was still alive? His first thought is, I can't even kill myself properly. I can't even do this properly. How do I kill myself? There's a question you get asked. I've been asked it. It results in you being scheduled if you give the wrong answers. Are you a risk to yourself or others? I've said yes to both. He said yes to both. They scheduled him and kept him in hospital for 3 months. All through that period, to doctors, nurses, orderlies, to anyone, family, friends who came to visit him, he'd talk about having had an accident, not trying to kill himself, having had an accident. So when it got to the end of his treatment period in the spinal ward, rather than send him home, they were so worried about him, they put him across in the psychiatric ward. After a month there, in order to give him a chance to get out and about, they said, why don't you go out for a day under your mother's supervision? So this is a 16-year-old boy. What did he choose to do on his day out? Go and get some piercings, whatever. Went out to Penrith to get some piercings on the train. On the way back from Penrith, the train stopped at Mount Druitt station. The doors opened. It was a classic Sydney double-decker train with the single deck at each end. And Matt is there in his wheelchair. And this guy got on the train and said, Jesus, what happened to you? And for the first time, Matt said, I tried to kill myself. The bloke sat down and said, well, what are you going to do about it? got off three stations later. We're on a national manhunt to find that man who is clearly Australia's greatest philosopher, because that turned Matt's life around. So his motto now is, well, what are you going to do about it? When I interviewed him, we got to the end, and it was at a meeting room in an office down the road. And I was sitting, long-shaped table, I was sitting right at one end. He was at the very end of the table. And I said, Matt, I've asked a few people this question, and it's a difficult question. There's a paradox in this question. Do you think you had to get to this terribly dark part of your life in order to turn it around? And I said, it's particularly relevant to you, Matt, because of your mobility. I couldn't say because you're in a wheelchair. I thought, I'll use the phrase because of your mobility, not even your lack of mobility. I was trying to be polite. And he said, I'll answer that question in a second, John. But yes, I did have to get to that point in my life, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, on the other thing, I'm going to walk again. And I thought, good on you, mate. That's never going to happen, but you keep that objective. You keep that going. He's rebuilt himself. His legs are wasted away, but he's as fit as a fiddle. Last year, he won the Guinness World Book of Records record, not for disability, but for any person, of the greatest number of towel lifts in 1 minute. Now, towel lifts are, imagine a metal rod you might do push-ups on. You throw a towel over it and you pull yourself up like that. He owns the Guinness Book of Records record for that. That's how fit this young bloke is. He pushed himself back from the table and he took my breath away. He pushed himself back. He lifted this leg to here, all the way up, 90%, and this one to about there. He opened up his phone and he showed me him that day out at Royal Ryde Rehab Hospital in effectively an exoskeleton attached to a rod learning to walk again. And I said, mate, it's 2024, you're 24 years old, you're as fit as a fiddle, you've got the determination, the technology's going your way, you will walk again. And I can think of no greater story of hope in this book than his. But there are other people in the book as well. And I wrote the book so that I would hope every Australian can look into the book and see a part of themselves. My 88-year-old auntie, she'll be pleased she got a mention. Can you please tell her she got a mention if you meet her anywhere? Colleen Clark. My 88-year-old auntie read the book and looked at Pat Hall's chapter, and she'd had that similar life. Go to school, leave at 15, get married, do a menial job, have three kids. Literally, that's her as well. She saw herself in that. Preston Campbell is in there. If you're a rugby league fan, you'll remember Preston Campbell. He's an Indigenous guy from Tinga, up near Armidale Way. Lovely bloke. Flew down from the Gold Coast, walks into the city office building in a T-shirt, a pair of jeans and thongs, relaxed as all get out. As fit, I reckon, as he was when he played footy 15 years ago. And he tells his story about going down. I said to him, my mate, you must be one of those freaks who played rugby league from the age of like 10 or something. He said, no, I played one game of footy when I was 11. I got knocked unconscious so mum made me play soccer for the next 6 years, and then I started playing again. Within years of playing again, playing rugby league, he'd gone to Sydney, joined a first grade team and got the Dally M medal, like the Brownlow medal. Through all of that period, he stayed true to himself as a humble man, concerned about his family, looking after his wife and his kids, not going near the grog and the drinking and all of the other stuff that can go on in a sport. Dally M turned him around. He started drinking with all the boys, etc., etc. His wife left him. He went to see his wife and she said, no, I'm not taking you back. This was up at Coffs Harbour. Got back in the car, decided to run into a tree and kill himself. Survived that. A couple of years later, on the footy show, some of you might remember, a couple of young Aboriginal footballers had taken their own life. So he decided, I need to talk about this. I need to tell this story. So went up to Coffs Harbour, a bit stupidly, to be honest, and they filmed him at the tree, which is, you don't really talk in detail about the means by which someone takes their own life because it might encourage somebody at risk. Anyway, there they are at the tree doing the video, doing the TV. This car pulls up on the other side of the road. Bloke gets out, walks across, and says, I was the guy who was here 3 years ago when you ran into the tree. I called the ambulance and the police. So the book is full of these extraordinary sliding doors moments. I want to end, and it relates to the quote that is in there from Richard Nixon. My experience, and I still live with suicidality, I still live with depression, I'm medicated for those, I see a psychologist on a regular basis. For me, suicidality means that somewhere in my makeup, I sort of say the back of my head, but somewhere in my makeup, if things go badly wrong for me, particularly personally, as opposed to business, whatever it might be, if things go bad for me personally, if I catastrophise them, I still have the risk of suicide. Now, that's very hard for my wife to live with, very hard for my children to live with, but I do what I can to be more disciplined and more controlled in those situations, or frankly, just to avoid those situations so I don't run the risk. But I may live with suicidal ideation for my life, I likely will. I may live with depression for the rest of my life. But I've learnt to the best of my ability. I'm not a hero, I still get things wrong and I can fall off sometimes, but I try to get back on quickly. I've learnt how to get through them, and I've learnt to live this quote, and it's one that's relevant to the people in the book as well. So when Richard Nixon resigned in disgrace on the 9th of August 1974, 50 years ago this past August, he held a rambling press conference, and then some might know, walked out to the helicopter Marine One with his wife and with Pat Nixon and with Gerald Ford and Betty Ford, went out together, and then he got on the Marine One and gave a great wave and off he went. So he left office in disgrace, but he delivered this line without a written note in his hand, and it's a line that expresses my life and the life of many who live with suicide or have lived through a suicide attempt. And it's this: it's not until you've stood in the deepest valley can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain. Thank you.
A huge thank you to John for visiting the SMSA and speaking on this very important topic. SMSA members can borrow Profiles in Hope from our library on level 2. You can also purchase a copy from your local bookshop. We've included a link to our friends at Abbey's in the description. Thank you to our live audience who attended the talk and to those listening at home. We encourage you to reach out to Lifeline for support at 13 11 14 if you or a loved one is feeling impacted by the topics discussed in this recording. These details will be included in the description. Thank you for joining us.